Paul was a missionary. I like the story about the missionary who was down in Brazil, who ran a camp near the what is called the Parana River. Now, you've probably heard about piranhas. In fact, I've got a real piranha up in my study. It's not alive, but it's encased in plastic that a missionary gave to us back in the early 1980s when we were down in Venezuela. And it does have sharp teeth. And a whole school of piranhas can, I guess, strip the flesh from man or any other living animal in just a matter of seconds. And so this missionary near the Parana River, it got awfully hot in the summertime and upwards of 120 degrees, kind of like here in San Antonio, and he just kept thinking about swimming in that river. It had no pool, and so he thought this would be great to be able to swim in the river. And so he was leery because of the fact that it was the Parana River, and that would be something to be a little concerned about. And so he asked some of the people that were natives to the land, said, is it okay to swim in that river? And they assured him. They said, oh yeah, you can swim in that river because piranhas never bite unless they're swimming in schools, and they never swim in schools here. And so they assured him, it's okay. And so he decided to swim, and the rest of the summer he enjoyed swimming. And then months later he heard a story about a fisherman that had fallen out of a boat, and they never recovered his body. And that made him a little bit nervous. And so he began to ask around his neighbors and others if perhaps the man had been eaten by piranhas. And again they assured him, oh no. Because piranhas only bite when they swim in schools, and they never swim in schools here in the Parana River. So he said, well, why don't they swim in pool schools here in the Parana River? And they said, because of the alligators. Paul had piranhas, and he had alligators that he had to deal with. Somebody has rightly put it that Paul, wherever he went, caused either a riot or a revival. And back earlier, interestingly enough, here as we look last week in the opening verses of chapter 19, that there was a tremendous revival, a spiritual awakening among the people. They were even bringing all of their magical books and all of their satanic kinds of reading materials, and they were burning them. And there was a tremendous spiritual awakening. But following on the heels of the revival comes this riot, something that is out of the control of Paul. I think of that old joke, and I like to circulate old jokes because if you're over 50, you won't remember it anyway, or if you do, you'll be glad and you'll be telling it this week. But the old joke about the two frying eggs in the monastery, and they're looking at each other in the frying pan. The one says to the other, you know, it's out of the frying pan and into the fryer. And that was Paul. He was out of the frying pan and into the fryer here in chapter 19. Last night there were people still laughing 5 minutes later, so you may just want to laugh now. And it just sort of caught on as the College Station crowd and others sort of began to pick it up. No. Pressures were mounting in Paul's life. In fact, he said in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, he says, we're hard-pressed on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed. Can you identify with this? Perplexed. We don't know what to do, but not to the point of despair. We are persecuted, but not forsaken. We are cast down, but not destroyed. We are knocked down, but not knocked out, is the way one translation puts it. Life as a Christian, in case you haven't realized that yet, is a little bit like being on a roller coaster. There's a lot of ups and downs. There's a lot of high points in the Christian life. There's a lot of low points in the Christian life. You're not always going to be up high, because if you were, the thrill would be gone. What is the thrill of riding a roller coaster? It's all the ups and downs. At times you wonder, at least I do when I'm on a roller coaster. I don't ride them anymore. Connie loves them. But am I going to survive this? You know, how am I going to stand this pressure when it hits the bottom like this? It's not the tops that bother me, it's the bottoms, bottoming out. Paul describes the Christian life sort of like that. Now here's the background to this. eastern part of the Roman Empire had been pretty well evangelized, and so Paul has set his mind on going to Rome. He knows that he's got to go to Rome. So his mind and heart is set on going to Rome and sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ there at the very pinnacle, at the very point of Roman authority, with whoever God chose to allow him to share the gospel with. And here he is still in Asia. In verse 22, he was at Ephesus when this riot broke out. And again, the words translated literally here are, there was no small stir. We have it translated in the translation I use, the New King James, a great commotion. It was a time of incredible trouble, of disturbance. In fact, it's the same word that was used back in Acts chapter 12 and verse 19 when Peter was miraculously delivered from prison in the middle of the night. And the next morning, when the Roman soldiers realized that Peter was gone, that the angel had delivered him, they didn't know all of that. All they knew was he wasn't there. And the Bible says, Luke writing that same passage there earlier in Acts, he says there was, when the soldiers found out Peter wasn't there, there was no small stir. Meaning, heap big trouble. We've got a major problem, a Donnybrook on our hands. And it was something that arose rather quickly. It was soon out of hand. And it was beyond the control of Paul. Now, let me ask you a question. Have you experienced that recently in your life, that your circumstances, whether they be in your business or in your private life, in your family, whatever it may be, that all at once you discovered your circumstances are beyond your control? But I simply remind you that they're never beyond God's control. And here was something that was out of hand as far as Paul was concerned. He's sort of in the background in all of this. You could almost read this and get the feeling Paul isn't even there, except for a couple of verses where he wanted to go to the theater, he wanted to address this huge crowd that had now gathered there because the trade and the temple were in disrepute. They were perhaps going to be destroyed, at least that's what the Ephesians thought. But it came on so quickly, it was like a storm. A couple of months ago, we had one of those rare storms that blew through the city. Almost forgot what rain was and hail. And that morning I went out, it was on a Saturday morning, I went out to run on the golf course, and it was rather ominous. The sky was very threatening, but I thought, well, it's been threatening before. I've got a half hour, I get out here and run. And so I took off and I got down the course, and boy, it got real dark. I mean, just black. Some of you may remember that when it came through the heart of the city. And I went underneath the overpass there at Almas Golf Course, underneath where the trains go over. And as I went towards that underpass, I saw maybe 10 or 12 golfers that had stopped there underneath because they thought it's starting to rain and it was looking real threatening. And so, smart aleck me, I ran by them and I said, "You bunch of chickens." I kept running. I wouldn't go stop. I said, "You bunch of chickens, why are you giving up so quickly?" And they all kind of laughed, and I don't remember what they said, but I made my turn, started back towards Bassey Road, when all at once, a streak of lightning shot right across the front of me. And one of the loudest claps of thunder I'd ever heard. And it got my attention. And I headed for the men's room. And for about 15 minutes, I was holed up in the men's room with about 12 other golfers in the men's room. One of those serendipitous delights of life. And we watched as the hail came down and the rain, and within 15 minutes it was gone. It was over. All we could do was simply ride it out. And that's what Paul was doing here. He was riding out this riot. It was beyond his control, but he knew it wasn't beyond God's control. And so all he could do was wait. Now, I want you to notice the spotlight's put on four different individuals here. First, this man, Demetrius. Look at verse 24. Here was the problem that arose concerning the way. That's the new way of designating Christians, by the way, in the book of Acts, is they are people of the way. They know the way. They know the way to eternal life. They know the one who is the way, the truth, and the life. So they're called people of the way. In verse 23, "And a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Diana, brought no small profit to the craftsmen." Now there's a problem. Demetrius was a man who was foremost concerned about his prophet. And he saw this as a profit and loss kind of situation because Paul's preaching had been so powerful and the message of the gospel had been so penetrating in all of Asia that it literally threatened this great religious monstrosity, this worship that centered around Artemis or Diana. Now let me say a few things about her. The end of verse 35 indicates that they believed that she had some kind of a heavenly origin. Some believe it was a meteorite 200 or 300 years B.C. that fell out of the heavens, and it sort of resembled a multi-breasted woman. And so this became a focus of their worship here in this part of Asia. And they even built this great temple to sort of honor her and from which they could worship her. And this temple was situated between two major hills in the area, and whenever you go into the city of Ephesus, you can see the remains of that temple and how it is the focal point. And some of us are going to be, Lord willing, visiting that very place at the end of October. And you'll see that temple as it overlooked the city. And the dimensions of that city were rather incredible. It measured 430 feet long, longer than a football field. It was 160 feet wide. It had hundreds of 100 columns that each were 55 feet high. In fact, it was such a magnificent structure that it was considered to be one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And you can imagine it was a major tourist attraction. In fact, once every year in the springtime, they had this festival in honor of this great goddess Diana or Artemis. And people from all over the world, all over that part of Asia, the Roman Empire, would come there to Ephesus in order to worship this false goddess. And there were trades that built up around it. There were silver replicas of the great temple that were made by these craftsmen, of which Demetrius was the president of the guild. And they would make these replicas of the temple and they would sell them for tremendous profit. And so here were these men now, through the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ, that were being hit right where it hurts the most for most men, and that's in the pocketbook. So the real issue behind this is these silver shrines that were made for devotees to dedicate in her temple. In fact, they sort of became a good luck charm. If you had one of these on you and you were traveling, then it might protect you because this was a replica of the temple of the great goddess Diana. It was sort of like silver or gold crosses. Many people wear them today or have them, and you can almost picture that they would have had one of these silver replicas of the great temple of Diana perhaps hanging from the rearview mirror of their donkey. Sort of a good look charm as we're traveling. All of the commercial and religious life in Ephesus centered around the worship of Diana. I can't stress that enough. Everything I've read on Ephesus, that was sort of the focal point of the city, much like the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty in New York. Or the Alamo here in San Antonio. People come to see it. People would come there to see it. And so Demetrius here is extremely concerned because he sees that their trade has been tapering off and their profits were not nearly as great this year as they were the year before. So he's concerned. He gets them all together, alert them, what's going on. And he sort of whips up the crowd into some kind of a frenzy here. Reminds me of the man who was downcast and gloomy, and a friend asked him what the problem was, and he said, well, he said, my wife has just made me a millionaire. And the man says, well, what's wrong with that? And he said, well, I used to be a multi-millionaire. And that was the problem here. These guys used to be wealthy, and now they're not making nearly as much. The power of the gospel, I can't emphasize this enough, because I think Dr. Luke does an incredible job here in verse 26, where he talks about the power of the gospel as it related, as it was translated, as it was delivered through the Apostle Paul. Notice in verse 26, moreover you see, he said that here that not only at Ephesus, but throughout almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away many people, saying that they are not gods which are made with hands. Now here was the real conflict. Paul was saying there's only one true God. He is spirit, and we must worship him in spirit and in truth. As Jesus said, there are no such things as gods that are made with human hands. So obviously when Paul came preaching that message, Demetrius and others saw that as a direct attack upon their business. And there was a conflict here, no question about it. So he spells out the threat of his ministry in verse 27. He says, not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but the temple as well. He said, we got a problem here. Number one, our trades are at stake. Number two, the temple of the great goddess Diana is at stake. So we've got to do something about this problem. I can't wait. We got to deal with it. And he whips the crowd up into some kind of a frenzy. And a mob scene soon results. Notice the response of the people in verse 28. And when they heard this, they were full of wrath. You can imagine that many of you today, and I would be too, somebody said, came in here and deliberately decided that they were going to destroy the Alamo. Or we're going to take bulldozers down and uproot the Riverwalk. We're going to change that whole area. Hey, that's what people come here for. And some of you have businesses that are directly related to the Riverwalk, the Alamo. And some of you, just simply because you're long years here, you have almost a religious kind of value placed on the Alamo. And we all agree it stands for something wonderful in our country, in the history of our country. And so if somebody came in and said, we're going to destroy that, we would immediately have thousands of people that would gather at the Alamo Dome. Couldn't hold everybody. And that's what happened here. They tell us that this theater, which, by the way, the remains have been uncovered of this great theater, and you can see pictures of it today, and it's as it's been restored, the ruins of it. Some of the most incredible, magnificent ruins in all of Asia. And this theater seated 25,000 people, and it stood at the end of what is known as the Arcadian Way, which was a marble-covered street that ran from one end of the city of Ephesus to the other. And it was where they had all of the businesses and all of the shops along the side of the road, and much of their commerce sort of was between the great temple of Diana and the great theater at the other end. And they all go down to the theater and they gather there. And I would imagine that even the theater itself could not contain the 25,000, or more than 25,000 people, could not contain all the people that had gathered. And some cried one thing and some cried another thing. And notice it says that in verse 32, some cried one thing and some cried another thing, for the assembly was confused and most of them didn't even know why they'd come together, which is usually what happens in a mob. A few know what it's about and the others are anxious to find out. But there was just confusion. Back in February, when all of our pastors here, along with many other pastors in the city and throughout the country, gathered in the Georgia Dome. 40-some thousand pastors, mainly men, just a few women sprinkled throughout the audience. But I don't remember who the speaker was, but I'll never forget what he did. He said, all right, I want all of you men, at the count of three, to shout your denomination. So at the count of three, everybody shouted their denomination. And I was sitting with one of the other pastors here at church, Bill Coase, and I couldn't even tell what Bill said. It was just confusion. It was all muffled. Try it sometime. If we were to shout this morning, all right, at the count of three, everybody shout, what is your source of income? Where do you work? We probably wouldn't be able to make out anything. Just confusion. But then the speaker did something that I'll never forget. He said, now, at the count of three, I want all of you men to shout out the name of your Lord. At the count of three, one, two, three, everybody shouted out, Jesus! And it was as clear as a bell. And he made his point. He's the one that brings us together. Well, most of them didn't even know why they were there. A remarkable sense of ironic humor here by Dr. Luke as he mentions this. Now this introduces a second man. I just say a couple comments about Alexander. The man Alexander. Look in verse 33. And when they drew Alexander out of the multitude, you get the feeling here Alexander was not a willing, compliant person. He was just sort of drawn out of the multitude. He was a Jew. Now, there was another problem. Because, you see, the Jews had something in common with Christians, and that is that they too believed there was only one true God, and there were no gods that were made by human hands, and there was a rather large segment, a population of Jewish people in the city of Ephesus, and so they chose Alexander to represent them. And the reason they wanted Alexander to speak to that great crowd of people that had been gathered was because Alexander, they realized that they might become the focal point of the problem. They were going to get caught up in the midst of it. and they might suffer the backlash. It may be another Jewish pogrom, so to speak, persecution against the Jews. And so Alexander wanted to deflect that criticism and defend the Jews. But notice when they found out that he was a Jew, he motioned with his hand, he wanted to make his defense to the people, but in verse 34, when they found out that he was a Jew, all with one accord, for about 2 hours, cried, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians, Megale, he, Artemis, Ephesion," is what they're saying. Great is the temple of Diana, great is the goddess Diana. For 2 hours they go on with this chant. Can you get the picture in your mind of what was really going on here? 2 hours. Max Lerner wrote in The Unfinished Country, "Every mob, in its ignorance and blindness and bewilderment, is a league of frightened men that seeks reassurance and collective action." Great description of a mob. They kept on crying out the same phrase, prompted by the sight of this hated Jew. Now that comes to the third man, city clerk. The mayor, look at him. This man kept all the records. He was the executive officer of Ephesus. In verse 35, when the city clerk, the mayor, the executive officer, quieted the crowd, he said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there who does not know that the city of Ephesus is the temple guardian, the great goddess Diana, and of the image which fell down from Zeus?" He said, that's a given. Everybody knows that. Why are we crying out for 2 hours here? It's unnecessary. It's kind of like that bumper sticker that you frequently see. Maybe you have one, and I venture to say there probably won't be that many around the church parking lot next week. But I love my husband. You've seen it. I love my wife. You've seen it. I look at that and I say, are you trying to convince yourself? Do you need this to remind yourself as you go out and get in the car? I do. I love my husband, don't I? I think I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, that's a given. You love your husband. You love your wife. Ought to be. That's what he's saying. Hey, look, if Diana is this great, if Diana is this important to us, then it's a given. We don't have to stand here and for 2 hours cry out, she's great. Ridiculous. And so, this leads to his words in verse 36. "Therefore, since these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly. For you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of your goddess." Paul had probably not said anything against the goddess other than the fact that he was simply preaching the one true God and faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. He takes the blame away from Paul and his companions in verse 37, "For you brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of your goddess. Therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls, there are judges. Let's go before them. Let's not have any kind of an insurrection." The reason why was because Ephesus was one of the few free cities in Asia, meaning it was under Roman authority and Roman domination, but it was off limits to Roman authorities. They had their own authorities. And Rome sort of took a hands-off policy and said, look, as long as you can govern yourselves, then we're not going to get involved. We'll let you govern yourselves. But if things get out of hand, then we're going to step in. And that was often the case in free cities in the Roman Empire. And so the mayor realizes, if we don't get a handle on this, if we don't quieten this mob and get things under control, then we're going to find the strong arm of Rome is going to come in here. He said, do you people want that? That was his argument. Look at verse 40. "For we are in danger of being called in question for today's uproar, there being no reason why we may give to account for this disorderly gathering." And when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly. Now let me just say some things about Paul. This was a crisis experience in Paul's life. I want you to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. We're going to conclude this morning by looking at this passage. The Apostle Paul himself refers to this experience in two passages. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 32, Paul writes, regarding the resurrection of Christ, he said, look, if after the manner of men I fought with beasts at Ephesus, what advantage is that to me if there is no resurrection? What didn't profit me to fight with these beasts at Ephesus? Now, we know Paul was a Roman citizen. Roman citizens could not be thrown to wild beasts. The Christians who were thrown to wild beasts were not Roman citizens. And therefore, he says, When he speaks of wild beasts at Ephesus, he must be referring to men. Plato, the Greek philosopher, said that mobs are likened to wild animals. It's out of control, ferocious, dangerous. And Paul saw these men at Ephesus in this way. Now, when you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 8 through 10, here were three things that Paul learned. Three valuable lessons that Paul learned in the midst of this crisis, this event that was out of his control. And this is really what I want you to take home with you this morning. Paul's speaking of the affliction that he suffered in Asia. And even though he doesn't say Ephesus, most believe that it was the experience at Ephesus that I just related to you that Paul is writing about here in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Look in verse 8. For we do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, unknowledgeable of our trouble. The word here is affliction, stress. We call it today stress, pressure, incredible pressure that came to us in Asia. That we were burdened beyond measure, above strength, so that we despaired even of life. In other words, our very lives were in danger at that moment. Yes, we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead, who delivered us from so great a death, and does deliver us, in whom we trust that He will yet deliver us. Now, there were three things that Paul learned from this stressful experience. We call stress something that keeps us awake at night, doesn't it? And it makes for sort of harassed kind of nights, and it makes for harried and hectic kinds of days, and it leaves us sort of exhausted and helpless. And that may be where some of you are this morning. All stressed out, we say. And Paul could identify with that. But in the midst of that, he learned some valuable lessons. Three lessons. Number one, he learned that God is the God of all comfort, who comforts us every time we are in this kind of stress. He always comforts us in the midst of it. Back in verse 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His abundant mercies, He is the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all of our tribulations, our stress, in order that we may be able to comfort others who are going through similar kinds of stress. He learned that God is the God of all comfort. One of the great paradoxes of the Christian life, even some would say a contradiction of the Christian life, is that we are more apt to experience the grace of God in the midst of difficulty rather than in the midst of prosperity. And I think you know what I'm talking about. I listened to Steve Ramos a couple of weeks ago as he explained to the family God had taken Yoli. She was His gift to them. And then he goes, he speaks of her in such a wonderful way, and speaks of God in such a wonderful way to say that we would never have a family experience the grace of God like we had. God's grace, God's comforting power. Paul said, I sense that, and you have too if you've been through a similar thing. Secondly, Paul learned through experience something that only enhanced his ministry in verse 4, that we might be able to comfort others who are going through similar kinds of stresses in their lives and problems. I'm finding that as a pastor, one of the great benefits of being in the position that I am in, and the other pastors say the same, is that I am able to put people in touch with other people who are suffering the same kinds of things. I have done that as recently as just a couple of days ago, and saying, I know somebody that's gone through what you've gone through, and I think he can help you. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. There's things that I cannot identify with in the lives of people, other things I can. I've had a lot of hurts in my life. I've had a brother who's committed suicide. I've had both of my parents who've gone to be with the Lord. We've had a certain amount of physical problems in our family. And we've had stresses and we've had strains, and there's things that we can identify with, but there's other things that we cannot. But that's the beauty of the body of Christ, as we all are able to be used of God. And then thirdly and finally, Paul experienced the delivering power of God. He was at the point of despairing even of life itself, but he experienced the tremendous delivering power of God. He was sort of, as he says here, like a beast that was pressed beyond measure or loaded down beyond measure. Notice in verse 8, we're burdened beyond measure. And the idea here in the Greek is that of a beast of burden that's loaded down. You sort of get a picture of a burrow here that's just got this heavy load on it. It's just being crushed right down to the ground. And that may be where some of you are this morning. You're just feeling the stresses of your circumstances in life. crushed to the point. Paul says, I know. I know how that feels. I've been there. I feel your pain. He says, I know it. I know what it is. But then he says, I experienced the delivering power of God. Verse 10, who delivered us from so great a death and does deliver us, in whom we trust that he will still deliver us. And if he doesn't, you're going to experience the ultimate deliverance, which is right into his very presence. So you can't lose. You can't lose. No way. Whenever we no longer trust in ourselves and our ability to pull things off, but rather God's ability, we have learned an invaluable lesson in life. We talked about that this last week as you as a congregation adopted this new church budget. And I look at it and I say, I don't know where it's coming from. That's good. That's good. I think there ought to be something in every budget, not only a church budget, your budget, that you have to really trust God for. And then watch God supply. And he always does. That's his track record. He's so faithful. And he uses us, and it becomes an incredible lesson for each one of us that we see that even though I cannot see the way clear how this is going to take place, I can't see my way, I can't see our way out of this, but God is all-powerful. And we've seen him provide in miraculous ways, and we're going to see him provide again. And he uses us all in the process. You know, just as a side note, and I quit with this, today we honor Paul. Demetrius has been forgotten. Nobody remembers Demetrius. Not an important person of history. He was living for money, but Paul was living for the master. You want to be remembered, then you've got to live for something other than money, men. You want your life to count. You want people to immortalize you long after you're gone. They're not going to do it if you're just simply living to make a living. Got to be something more than that. God makes sure that his people are remembered. Let's bow our heads in prayer. You may be here this morning and you've never trusted Jesus Christ. You know, behind everything I've said this morning, I hope you haven't missed it, is a relationship. That's what sustained Paul in these difficult times in his life. A relationship with the living Christ. If you don't have that, you're missing out on the greatest relationship. You may have a great wife, you may have a great husband, great children, great friends, family. But if you don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ, you are the poorest of the poor. He invites you to get to know him. You say, but my sin. He's holy, and I've got sin, and we all have sin. I can identify with Paul, chief of sinners. The older I get, the more I become aware of my own sin problem. Jeremiah said, the heart of man is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Only God can really know my heart. I don't stand up here with any pretense this morning. I'm a man just like you men. I struggle with the same things that you men struggle with. I hurt at times just like you men hurt. But I do know that we have a wonderful God. And he gives more grace when the burdens grow greater, and he sends more strength when the labors increase. To added afflictions, he adds his mercy. To multiplied trials, he giveth more peace. His love has no measure. His grace has no limit. His power has no boundary that's known unto men. But out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth, and he giveth, and he giveth again. We want you to get to know him this morning. Maybe your load's heavy and you just simply need someone to talk to. You're a Christian, but you need somebody to pray with, somebody that can come alongside you and be an encouragement to you. We'd invite you to come this morning. Let's stand together as we conclude with, he giveth more grace.